Will they or won't they? Congress, I mean, keep the government open. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today. This one is the 8th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There is going to be a government shutdown in 10 days. Or there's not going to be a government shutdown in 10 days. Right now, could go either way. But the point is, we are in yet another countdown. And as in years past, it is more likely than not that Congress is going to come up with a continuing resolution that'll keep the government open until a real deal can be made. House Republicans, though, whence such a spending deal has to come, don't seem to have a plan for what any CR would look like, at least not one that's got a real chance in the Senate, much less of actually getting signed by the president. So they are floating lots of, shall we say, creative thoughts about how to move forward. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us going.
Rather than extending funding for the whole government, the House GOP is considering different funding expiration dates for different parts of government, like a deadline for military, transportation, and agriculture in a month or so, and other parts of government later. They're calling this a laddered continuing resolution, or CR, and to be honest, before this week, I'd never heard of it.
You're not the only one.
I had not heard the term either.
That was Sharon Parrott, who runs the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and Mark Schmidt, who directs the Political Reform Program at New America. The phrasing was even new for Tom Kahn at American University, who spent 20 years working on the House Budget Committee.
And I think the reason I've never heard of it before is that it's just headed to failure. It's an attempt to work around the fact that House Republicans are having trouble governing.
According to Roll Call, the technique was used once back in the early 90s, even if it wasn't called a laddered CR then. But the reason Kahn and others say this workaround is unworkable now is because it doesn't address the impasse over overall spending levels. Here's the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities' Sharon Parrott again.
Because if you start to go forward with some bills and you haven't made those top line decisions, you run the risk of doing some bills and then not having enough resources left at the end.
If the House GOP does figure out a way to make this work, which New America's Mark Schmidt thinks is unlikely.
One difference it might make is that you might not have the big shutdown. And the big shutdown forces Congress to say, okay, we've got to get this stuff done because you're shutting down everything.
A laddered CR allows Congress to create a series of partial shutdowns, which could mean less pressure from the public to get a comprehensive deal across the finish line. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Wall Street midweek, kind of middling. Actually, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, this might not sound exciting, a new report from the Center for Microeconomic Data at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, but trust me on this one, it matters. Talked about this for a hot second on the show yesterday, the New York Fed's latest data on household debt. Debt of all kinds, credit cards, car loans, mortgages, all up. Delinquencies as well, especially for credit cards. Yet, as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports, the percentage of people who have debt in collections is about as low as it's been in the past 20 years.
Just before the pandemic started, the New York Fed found about 9% of people had bills that were so overdue they ended up in collections. Now, less than 5% do.
Through the COVID recession and since then, it really has hit historic lows, the percent of consumers with debt in collection.
Josh Bivens is with the Economic Policy Institute.
To me, that mostly is a story of just the very large amount of pandemic fiscal relief and aid we gave households. The economic impact payments and the expanded unemployment insurance.
That gave a lot of people a big buffer and helped them pay down debt, he says. So did the 3.5-year pause on student loans.
it's quite a bit of money that people could use to make sure they weren't falling behind other debts.
More recently, Frederick Blavin at the Urban Institute says there's been another factor at play, too.
In April of 2023, the major credit bureau agencies stopped including medical debt collection items under $500 in credit reports.
Medical debt previously made up about 60% of debt in collections, but data shows it doesn't actually tell you much about someone's creditworthiness. Chi-Chi Wu at the National Consumer Law Center says the change is a good thing, but just because that collections debt is no longer showing up on people's credit reports doesn't necessarily mean they're doing better financially, or that that debt doesn't exist.
It most definitely still exists and still burdening consumers. It just means that the harmful impact of debt collection items on credit reports is no longer there.
Which is not insignificant, she says. Credit reports can determine a lot, whether someone gets a loan, a job, or an apartment. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Good news, bad news today for home buyers. The Mortgage Bankers Association says the average rate on a 30-year fixed fell last week from 7.8% to 7.6%. That's the good news. The bad news, you can see this coming, I'm sure, is that the average rate on a 30-year fixed is still 7.6%. That's just an additional challenge for would-be buyers in this economy. In a real estate market where they're already dealing with way not enough homes, lots of interested buyers, and information overload about how to navigate it all, kind of makes you look at it and say, shouldn't there be an app for that? James Rodriguez covers housing for Insider, and he wrote recently about the quest for an Amazon of real estate. James, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So look, I'm exaggerating here only a little bit, but you can basically refinance your mortgage at an ATM if you figure out which buttons to push. And I guess my question is, why have we not been able to disintermediate the home buying process yet?
You know, I think that's a question that a lot of people have been asking, specifically over the past 20 years. You'd think back to when companies like Zillow and Trulia came around and they revolutionized one big part of the home buying process, which is the search process. And you know, in the decades since that innovation, you've had companies claiming that they can revolutionize the rest of the buying process as well. And they've raised billions of dollars promising to make it simpler, less complicated, less frustrating, have it all in one place. And that really hasn't happened yet. And actually what it boils down to is home buying is such a complicated transaction. And it's regulated by this dense web of not only national laws, but state and local laws as well. And so that's been tough to overcome.
What I hear you saying is it's not so much a technology problem, right? The technology exists. We just can't. It's a human behavior thing, right?
Exactly. So I think what people are working on now is bring the transaction in one place, create something like a housing super app or an Amazon of real estate to guide consumers through every step of the process, not necessarily cut out steps of the process, but make it easier to navigate.
So Zillow, since you mentioned it, is working on this, you know, housing super app thing. First of all, what do we know about it?
No, the truth is not a lot. They've been teasing it for the past couple of years, but the details have been pretty scant to this point. What you kind of imagine, though, is something, you know, that kind of funnels the consumer through every step. And that's kind of what they've been pitching to analysts, is this kind of one-stop shop where, yes, consumers still have choice in terms of, you know, where they get a mortgage from, where they get title insurance from.
Right.
But guiding consumers through every step of the process, I think, is kind of the name of the game and what companies are chasing right now.
Four words for you. Real estate agent lobby, right? I mean, they're not going to be in favor of this for a second.
Yeah. And that's the thing, too, is what we actually saw during the pandemic is when home buying gets more difficult, people actually do rely on agents more. You had more buyers using agents in 2023, 88% of buyers than they did in 2019 when you had 82% of buyers using agents. And so that's another challenge as well, is how do you replicate that purely through an online app? And I think what some companies are saying is, you know, we don't want to get rid of the agent. We want to work with the agent and incorporate them in this process. And you have brokerages as well that are chasing this kind of super app or end-to-end system as well.
Right. Just to bring the news into this, though, there was that case out in Kansas City about the National Association of Realtors and, you know, realtor fees and all of this. And I'd be really thrilled to get rid of losing 6% on my sale, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the really interesting thing, too, right now, is you have these two massive multi-billion dollar class action lawsuits. A verdict came down last week, $1.8 billion in favor of these plaintiffs, who are this huge class of home sellers who say that they basically got ripped off by being forced to pay not only their agent, but also the buyer's agent as well, which is typically how home sales work. And so it's actually a really kind of seismic decision that I think will have a lot of ripple effects. We've already seen more lawsuits being filed. You know, there's a lot more to come on that front.
So getting this back to the idea of an app and trying to do as much as can be done online, on the theory that technology will eventually win out, because that's kind of the way society seems to be developing, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years until I can buy a house soup to nuts on my phone?
You know, it's tough to roll out kind of a nationwide app right now. There are companies that will do kind of a one-stop shop for you right now. I think that the big question is, how willing are consumers to submit so much, you know, power in this whole process to just one entity? And what's tough is creating kind of this one-stop shop that's actually taking over or providing a really meaningful solution to a big range of people.
Right. Amazon, but for home buying. James Rodriguez, he's a senior reporter at Insider. James, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
The holiday retail season is right around the corner. Actually, it's here already because you know there are people out there who have already started or even finished their shopping. The National Retail Federation says we are going to spend between 3 and 4% more than we did last year, in the aggregate just shy of $1 trillion. But even outside this hectic and oh-so-critical shopping season for small retailers, running a business, holidays or not, can be stressful. Here's today's installment of our series, My Economy.
I am Ashley Morgan, and I'm the owner of Unglued in Fargo, North Dakota. So Unglued is a modern handmade gift shop that connects people to over 200 local and regional makers. And in the store, we sell the work of makers that ranges from like kitchen items, which could be screen printed tea towels with Midwestern sayings, to hot sauces, and everything from like bath bombs to beard oils. It's been really challenging as a small business, especially in the craft world, to keep a sustainable shop. And so we learned that the hard way when we opened our Sioux Falls location, which was our second brick and mortar. We were able to keep it open for about 2.5 years, but it just kept getting worse. And we did take out a second mortgage to like keep our payroll going and did a lot of things like that. But ultimately did close that store. It was really hard. I was crying on the floor in our kitchen, petting my bulldog, being like, we can do this. I don't know how we can do this. And that's really the moment that we started to realize, like, okay, we've given it all. Everyone's given it their all. Part of with Sioux Falls not working is I realized how much time and attention was given there. And so I was suddenly able to give it to our Fargo store more. And so we were able to really start to go through our inventory better, give our Fargo store new life. That kind of helped grow more of an audience and some income too as well from it. So easily our biggest cost now is labor over our rent. We have two new full-time people, which is new for us and me. I've been not so responsible for people to be able to be full-time with us. And so now I really feel the responsibility we need to keep this sustainable to be able to keep it going, because I can't just be a one-man show, one-woman show with this. I am totally surprised that I'm doing a retail gift shop, especially in the consignment world, which is kind of a weird world. I never would have expected that is where my life would lead, but seeing the whole mission behind it, how it connects the community to makers, connects people to each other, is really the driving force behind it and what I love. I would say that I will be in the world of craft in some way for the long haul.
Ashley Morgan, the owner of Unglued in Fargo, North Dakota. We need you to do this series, whether you are glued or not. So please, let us know what's going on in your life, your business. Take your pick. Marketplace.org/myeconomy. Coming up,
we've got a bike stand back there that's a more aesthetically pleasing bike stand.
Whatever sells, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 40 today, a 10%, 34,112. The NASDAQ improved 10 points, less than a 10%, basically flat, finished at 13,650. The S&P 500 added 4, a 10%, 43,082. Electric vehicle maker Rivian slowed 2.4% today despite posting a smaller-than-expected quarterly loss and issuing an upbeat full-year forecast. Tesla off just a tad less than a 10%, should you be curious. Occidental Petroleum grew 1.6% today on better-than-expected quarterly earnings. ExxonMobil gave back 1.2%. Chevron dipped 1.4%. Sam Fields was telling us about household debt and credit card delinquencies. So how about some credit card companies, shall we? MasterCard picked up 0.2%. Visa subtracted about 0.1%. Discover dropped 0.6%. Bond prices went up. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 4.5% on the nose. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. To aviation now. Those seats right up at the very front of the plane with the really great views out the front. There is an industry-wide shortage of commercial pilots. Has been for a while, but it's gotten so bad that one subsidiary of American Airlines is offering qualified aviators bonuses of up to $250,000 to come fly for them. PSA Airlines operates shuttle flights throughout the Midwest, the Northeast, and the South, but has had to cut back on its service because it doesn't have enough pilots. And as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports, that is a problem that's rippling through the whole aviation sector.
This problem has been decades in the making, says analyst Christopher Raitt at Third Bridge. The rise of drones disrupted the military pilot pipeline, and training on your own can cost upwards of $100,000. Then came COVID and a wave of early retirements.
It's quite clear that demand is outstripping supply today.
Raitt says North America is short more than 10,000 pilots, but not everyone feels the pinch equally.
The mainline carriers, think United, Delta, American, they're advantaged. They pay the most of all the carriers. They also fly the newest aircraft.
They've been able to poach pilots from regional carriers like PSA. Now PSA is hoping to poach from cargo carriers like FedEx.
It will be a win-win for the passenger airlines and for FedEx.
Shipping consultant Satish Jindal says demand for air freight has fallen as ground operations have become more efficient.
And as a result, they've ended up with more pilots than they need.
FedEx estimates it has about 700 excess pilots, and in a memo last week, actually encouraged them to take flight for PSA. But $250,000 notwithstanding, it could be a hard sell, says Robert W. Mann Jr., an airline consultant and former executive.
It's not going to be the most desirable flying, and it won't be anything like what you're doing at FedEx or UPS.
For one thing, despite the bonuses, regional carriers generally pay less, and pilots might fly multiple short legs a day, meaning more traffic, weather, and crying babies or other passengers. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
It's a long-standing belief here at Marketplace that you can talk economic headlines until the cows come home. But if you're not talking about how people are living their everyday lives in this economy, you are missing the boat. People and the people running companies. That's why we spend so much time talking with business owners about the day-to-day realities of what they do. Sales, managing inventories, hiring and firing, inflation. Now also content creation. Videos for TikTok and Instagram and YouTube, newsletters, even podcasts. Marketplace's Justin Ho talks small business and big media platforms at a bike store in Newbury Park, California.
The store is called Worldwide Cyclery. It sells high-end mountain bikes and bike components. And in the middle of the store, the company set up a podcasting and video studio. Jeff Cayley is the owner.
So we have different lights and everything set up here for different videos. We've got a bike stand back there that's a more aesthetically pleasing bike stand for videos rather than the more kind of industrial looking types that you'd see in the back of our shop.
There's a green screen, foam on the walls to dampen sound, and plenty of props.
Some custom painted shoes with some bike wheels on there. I'm not sure where this rhino came from.
Kelly's company has been publishing videos, articles, reviews, and other content for about 8 years. The idea is to showcase the thousands of products Worldwide Cyclery sells. Take this video that has 33,000 views on YouTube.
Hello, fellow mountain bikers. It is the month of May, and we are here to tell you the trending products that have sold this month that mountain bikers are buying with over...
Kelly says videos like this fit right into his business. Bike parts are technical. There's a lot to explain and compare.
You know, you look at this and you think, well, is this advertising or, you know, is this just media generation? And the answer is yes.
People might want to buy a product they see in a video, but if they like the video, they'll probably like the company too. And you actually don't need a fancy studio to do any of that.
So I started using my iPhone to just record myself.
That's Brandilyn Green. Back in 2014, she started a social media presence called Voice of Hair to highlight up-and-coming hairstylists. A few years later, she started selling her own hair products and recording videos with her hairstylists.
We would set up the camera and record and talk to the audience and show them the products we were using and how we were styling my hair.
Green says she spent money on ads, but they didn't generate much sales. Then last year, she filmed a video about scalp treatment on her phone.
Here are three things you should try to reduce flaking. Number one, use...
And when she posted it, it got 37,000 likes on Instagram. And Green sold out of her scalp treatment product in 2 days.
Because I just showed them how I used it versus something that was really polished. People didn't care about that. They wanted to see how something worked and what the transformation was going to be.
In some cases, business owners earn revenue directly from the content they generate.
You know, normally for most people, if you have, let's say, 1 million combined followers, you should be generating a pretty decent income from your social media.
James Beck owns a hot sauce shop in Houston called iBurn, and ever since 2020, he's been posting videos under the name Hot Sauce Boss. They started as a way to promote the sauces Beck sells, but he soon realized that videos about those sauces didn't always get a lot of views.
Because iBurn was launched as a gourmet hot sauce shop, and the majority of the content that really does well are the extreme content posts, where I'm doing the hottest things in the world.
So Beck focused more on filming himself eating ridiculously spicy sauces and raw peppers. Most of his videos get tens of thousands of views, and every so often, one goes viral and gets millions, like this one from earlier this year.
The Insanity Challenge. 4 chocolate skulls filled with super hot powder.
In mid-2021, TikTok started paying him for his videos. Beck says now his content business is very profitable.
More than my store, unfortunately.
Beck says he's working on creating his own line of hot sauces. He'll sell his first one directly through TikTok. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which, well, here you go. Saw this in the New York Times, that the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration came out with a consumer alert this week warning people not to bedazzle their steering wheels. No sequins, rhinestones, and the like, which, NHTSA says, can become projectiles if the airbag deploys. Now you know. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. I know I did this yesterday, but the news is what the news is. Crude oil, again, both benchmarks, Brent North Sea and West Texas Intermediate, down another 2% today. Point number one about that, looser financial conditions, as we have been covering. Point number two, fears of lower demand, which is to say a slowing economy, not just here either. Remember, oil is a global markets. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Justin Dueler, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Dorado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.